This is how this one is going to be. Except I want to share one thing with you, because this is an honest program. Being fairly new in it, and being when I learned that I was going to be a part of this program, it was bandied about who's going to be the speaker. And somebody says it's going to be Clarence S. And I said, who is Clarence S? And they started telling me about him, and that's where I got my first misinformation. They said that he is one of the first 100. Well, he's not one of the first 100, he's one of the first 40. But you know, he was messing around with this outfit called the Oxford Group back in 1938. Well, you know, since I sobered up, I'm able to do some basic arithmetic, and so I got to figuring that if this guy came in 1938, and he's talking to us in 1975, who's going to meet the plane and help him off of it? And so I was privileged to be out at the airport to meet this guy. And I was not prepared for what I saw, because he did not walk off of the plane. He jumped off of it. And not only that, he was bringing this beautiful thing along with him. And the first words he said, well, fellas, since I'm going to be here 3 days, I just brought the sex maniac along with me. But that's not the end of it. We went into the airport and started, and we're waiting on his luggage. And as this so often happens, they lost it. And I thought to myself, my gosh, what's this guy going to say? He comes, of all of the glamorous places in the world he's been, and to come to Topeka, Kansas is enough, but to lose his luggage. And you know what he said? And this is as true as it can be. He just smiled and he said, I'm so thankful that having come into this program, I have something to lose. And that's the kind of a guy that we have here today. And with that, I'd like to introduce to you Clarence S.
Well, thank you very much, Jim. I'm certainly pleased to be here, and I do want to thank all of you for inviting Grace and I to come and share this event with you. And before I do anything else, I want you to meet Grace. I refer to her as Amazing Grace. She is my bride of 4 years, and she is probably the greatest thing that ever happened to me since I came into this fellowship in 1938. Stand up, Grace, and say hello. What makes her so nice, she's also a rummy and has about 8 years in this program. She's an alcoholic. So that makes me an AA, and it also makes me an Al-Anon. So I'm both. To speak to a crowd such as this is a great privilege, and sometimes you wonder how to start. I never have any prepared talks. We had you stand up for a moment or so a while ago to rest your little behinds, and believe me, you're going to need it. Someone asked me how long I was going to talk. I said, how long do I have? And he says, well, take as long as you want. And so this was all kicked around a little while, and then I was informed over here by our tape crew over here. Ed tells me that he has 100 two-hour tapes at his disposal, and he wanted to know if I thought that was enough. Well, I think we'll make it. Well, we're here to talk about rummies and alcoholism and what blessings we've received here. First blessing we have since we've landed here is the terrific weather that we brought to you from Florida. I didn't know about this when I changed planes in Atlanta. I had the roughest trip I believe I've ever had on an airplane between Orlando and Atlanta. It was a most miserable weather, and the plane I was on happened to be the last one that landed on that type of a strip. The thing was going like this, and it's one of these great big 10-11 planes, too. And that was bobbing around like a cork. And when that Atlanta, that rain was pouring down in sheets. But when we got over here, this was lovely. But while my luggage got lost, they did ship the weather along all right. So here we are. Let's talk about some of the friends I've met here that I've met in years past. It's really nice to see some of my old friends. It's awfully nice to meet a lot of new ones. I am a fundamentalist in AA. I have never become a graduate. My practically 38 years of sobriety in this fellowship has been one that I have tried to follow out things that were taught me by my sponsor and the other people who preceded me, and then by dumb ignorance and luck and blessings, I have learned a good many other things, which has given me many blessings during my lifetime here. And I'd like to share some of these things with you today, and I'd like to talk about how this AA got started. You heard some history this morning about the New York area, and which was fine, and they do have a history, but I was not raised in New York AA. I was raised in Midwestern AA. I was raised in Ohio. My sponsor was Dr. Bob, and he taught me certain things, and he was a tough sponsor. I want you to know that, let me tell you something, some of the things about how I got here. This might be a good way to start. Because in a good many ways, I am a freak in AA. I have a lot of firsts. For instance, I came to a fellowship that did not yet exist. There was no AA when I arrived here. I became a member of the Oxford movement, which you heard Lois refer to this morning. Bill also was indoctrinated into the Oxford movement in New York. And I was indoctrinated in it in Akron, Ohio. Frankly, I didn't know what I was into. The only thing is, I want to tell you how this happened. I was on the bum. I had managed to drink myself out of jobs. I was unemployable. If you don't think I was unemployable, I'll tell you a few things to just wisen you up a little bit. I came into this fellowship in the depth of a depression, and these were in WPA days, and also Prohibition days. There was no booze when I came in here. Booze had been outlawed, so there wasn't any. But I wound up an alcoholic regardless of that. And I was married into a very clannish family at the time. Lois knows some of my ex-family. And I always had one, two, three, or four of them at my home at some time or other, usually all at once. And these people dictated policy in my home. And I didn't have much to say about it, and they used to have family meetings in my home, and they had these family meetings and discussions, And I was never invited to these discussions because I was generally the subject under discussion. And the discussions generally ran along the line as to whether or not they're going to throw me out again or let me back in again in my own home. Well, the time arrived finally that they gave me my one big last chance to stay with this august body. And this chance was predicated upon the idea that I should go to work for my wife's brother, Dorothy's brother. And he had a truck and a trailer, and he hauled merchandise from Cleveland to New York and back in this big tractor trailer rig. And I was to become his helper. Now, that has been way over 40 years ago, and to this day, I haven't had my hand on the wheel of that truck yet. First of all, when they put this proposition up to me, it scared me to death. I'd never been on a truck in my life, let alone drive one. And I knew this would be hard work, and I've always been adverse to hard work. I still am. I never got over that. I like hard work. I can lay right down the side of it and let it go, you know. It doesn't bother me a bit. But anyway, I had to take this challenge and agree to go on this job. So I shall never forget, we started off it was the beginning of winter, and we started off for New York on a trip, hauling merchandise. And it was one of those sleeper cabs where I was to sleep up above where the driver is, and he'd sleep on the seat when any sleeping was to be done. He had fixed up that little niche for me real nice and put a lace curtain and everything up there for me. It was real sweet. And I got up in that thing, and it scared me to death. I look out that window and watch that big trailer following me down with 20 tons of merchandise in it. And this scared the liver out of me. I was a chronic alcoholic. I was not a periodic, which means I was a consistent person. You could always depend on me. I was not one of these periodics. You know, there's two types of rummies that we have to contend with, the periodic and the chronic. Now, I'm a chronic. I'm drunk all the time, so people know what to expect from me. But these blooming periodics, these are the people that ought to be barred from everything. They are the people who give alcoholics a bad name. They do, you know. Sure, you figure it out. And these are the first ones that squawk when they get to step two and you start talking about sanity. They're the ones that tell you they're not nuts, you know. Now, listen, let me give you a description of these apes. This fellow, he gets a good job. He has a nice home, a nice family. He has a couple of cars in the garage, nice place to live in. Everything is going fine. And all of a sudden, without rhyme or reason, this dodo gets drunk, and believe me, it's a disaster area. Everything goes. The house goes, the furniture goes, the cars go back to the finance company, the wife goes, the kids go, everybody goes. The whole works is washed out with this periodic guy. What happens to this fella? First thing you know, he goes out and gets another job. And you know what kills me? He generally gets a better one than he had before. I have a resentment toward these people. And then he gets himself a new house, new furniture, new wife, new family, new everything, and starts all over again. And he starts climbing up that ladder, gets a little green stuff in his pocket, gets some jingle in his pocket, and gets a bank account. Everything going great. He gets reestablished in society and accepted back in the human race. And what does he do? The same thing over again. This is a repetition. He blows it all again, and then the whole thing crashes down. He lives. This is his way of life. And then he's the first guy, when he's talking that second step about restoring the sanity, perhaps, he's the guy who says, "Me nuts? I'm not crazy. I wonder what you call this kind of thing, this kind of behavior." Now, I never did that kind of stuff. So I resent people like that, naturally. Well, now, I'm a chronic, and we start off on this trip to New York, and my brother-in-law, naturally, the last thing he'd ever do would be buy me a drink, because he's taking me there to cure me from drinking. And I am sick, and I am shaking, and I'm in a terrible shape, and I don't have any clothes to wear to amount to anything, and the winter's setting in. And I'm up in that coop that he puts me in, and I'm shivering and shaking and scared to death. And he drives and drives and drives. I thought, does this guy ever stop for a rest? No. And I was trying to figure ways to get away from him. Before I started on this trip, I had secreted, I think, about $1.20 in dimes around my person. I had them in various pockets so they wouldn't rattle. And he didn't know that I possessed this capital. Okay? I probably stole it from some church collection. But I had it anyway. And I used to sell milk bottles and pick up bottles and trade them in for money like that. I used to pick up money in odd ways when it was laying around loose. Well, anyway, I had this capital, and he didn't know about this. And we stopped the next morning. I can remember this. We just passed over in a New York state. And he stopped at one of those roadside stands for breakfast. And his breakfast consisted of tomato juice and some cheese and all that sort of stuff. And boy, the thought of it made me ill. I couldn't handle it, of course. So then he gets back in the truck and on we go. And we rode and rode and rode till the following night we land into Albany, New York. Well, this is the first time he finally got tired enough to conk out. He had to rest. So he pulls his outfit over to the curbstone and parked it, and he told me he's going to take a nap for about an hour and a half. I thought, boy, this is great. So I says, that's wonderful. I says, this is Albany. This is the capital of New York. I always wanted to see the Capitol buildings. So this is the first chance I had to get away from this bird, and away I went. Well, I got into the first place I run into. I saw this was not a place for a man of my means, so I left and I went down the street further and found a place that was more suitable to a man of my estate, a real joint. And I got in there with my $1.20, which is enough to start any place in those days. And I found an angel in there, and this angel was a little odd, this fellow was. I knew he had some ideas. And he was buying me drinks like they were going out of style. And I was throwing them in about as fast as I could handle them. And then I left. I went in the men's room and went out a window and went the other way. And I left, see? Well, I guess he had to pick up the check. I'm not interested in those details. I know I left. And I started back for this truck, and not having had a drink for a day or two there, I guess these things hit me all at once when I was walking back there. And this boy is lying on his seat down there sleeping. And I attempted to crawl up into my nest, and in so doing, I stepped on this poor boy's face. And, of course, he came to life, and he realized that something was amiss here, and I smelled like a distillery. So church was out. So he drove me into New York City and threw me out. And there he left me there. He says, this is the end of the line. Don't ever come back to Cleveland. You're done. Nobody wants you there. You're not welcome. You're strictly on your own. Goodbye and go someplace, you know? So he wrote Dorothy, who was my wife at the time, and told her what he'd done, I guess. I only knew one person in New York City. Now, I want to tell you about the first miracle that has happened to me. My life is a succession of miracles. And I suspect every person here has some miracles in their life that they can point to. And the greatest miracle is that you ever found AA. But my first miracle occurred in New York City. I had never been in New York before. I knew nothing about it. I only knew one person in New York City. And this wasn't a very promising situation because it was another sister of his, one of the in-laws. I knew Virginia. And Lois knows Virginia McLeod very well, because eventually she wound up in AA too. Now here's what happened. I figured that here I am standing out here in New York. I don't have any money left. My capital had been shot in this joint. And I'm 600 miles from home, and I had to find some way to exist. And I thought certainly Virginia, who lived in Yonkers, I had been there on my honeymoon, so I knew where she lived. They were a very clannish family. We did everything together. And we honeymooned at her home, the whole family. Well, anyway, I made my way out to Yonkers to see Virginia. Thinking she'd help me, and I figured she ought to, because I figured she owed me some things. And I think I was right in my assumption there. But she didn't agree wholeheartedly, because I got out there, and I can only remember a couple items about that trip. First of all, Virginia lived way up on top of a hill, on Palisades there. But I didn't go up on that hill when I arrived in Yonkers. I went down the hill into the Italian section. And the Italian people in those days, they all made wine. I guess they still do. But a lot of them sold it in those days, and some of them shared it with their friends. And I went down in this Italian section, and I made friends. And I got myself slopped with this Dago Red. And by the time I got up to Virginia's house, I was probably a mess to observe, you know. But I only remember a couple things about that. I remember rolling around on the floor with her two little kids. She had two little baby daughters, about 2 and 3 years old. And I'm rolling around the floor with them. Now remember, I'm drunk, I'm dirty, and I stink. So Virginia takes a dim view of this deal. So she doesn't do anything but load me in the back of her car and take me down to that waterfront where her brother had thrown me out, and she did likewise. Now, this sounds like a sad tale. I remember that day, something that happened that day I shall never, never forget. I stood down there in that waterfront, and it occurred to me that day that I'm alone in this world. I'm 600 miles from home, and it wouldn't have made any difference if I was 6 feet from home. I wasn't welcome anyway. And it occurred to me that there wasn't one person in this whole world who cared one bit whether I was alive or dead. I shall never forget that feeling. Never. Well, I had to do something, and I survived. I'm not going into all the details of how I did this, but I did. As you see, I'm here. But something happened. Sometime later, Virginia had her doctor over there to talk to her, or see one of the kids, I guess. I don't know what the occasion was. But two of them got to talking about drinking, which was always a good topic in those days. And Virginia told her doctor about this visit of this brother-in-law of hers, who used to be such a nice guy, her favorite brother-in-law, and who's such a dirty, stinking, drunken bum now. And this doctor says, you know, that's odd. He says, I have a brother-in-law who was a lush like that, and he met some strange cult of people. And since he met this cult, he don't drink anymore, and he runs all over New York trying to fix drunks. And he says there's a Dr. Smith down in Akron, Ohio, who also belongs to this cult in Akron, and he spends all of his time fixing drunks. And he says if your brother-in-law ever gets back to Cleveland, maybe he can go down and see this Dr. Smith in Akron, Ohio, and maybe this doctor can fix him. Well, this doctor happened to be Dr. Leonard Strong, who happens to be Lois's brother-in-law, right? And that was the fellow. Now, this is way back, way back in the early 30s when this happened. Now, what do you think of the mathematical chances of me being here? There was a few fellas in New York City, Bill Wilson and a few of his cronies, who were doing their best to try to keep on the ball here and preach the sermon to people. And there was a handful of them up in Akron, Ohio. And I'm in New York, where I know nobody, and this is all going on. Here I am coming into contact indirectly with the two main moguls of the beginning of this fellowship, unknown to me. So Virginia wrote Dorothy the news about this doctor in Akron and told her that if I ever showed up, she should chase me down to Akron or take me down and meet this doctor, and maybe I could get fixed too. I don't know how long I stayed in New York. It was a long time, I know this, because there was bad weather again when I left. Everything happens to me at the beginning of winter. I don't know why this is. It's everything happens to me in lousy weather. And I got myself back to Cleveland. One fella took me to Erie, I remember, one trucker, and another one drove me the rest of the way into where I lived outside of Cleveland. And I thought, I lived in a snow belt in Cleveland. I lived in what they call Lyndhurst, Ohio, which is they have snow there up to 1st of July in that village. I don't know why, but it's just one of those things. But this was in the middle of winter, and I headed for my house. And I noted one thing when I got up on the front porch. The screens were still up, and the snow was this deep on the ground. I had to wade through this snow to get on the porch. And the screen doors are up, and the screens are up, and everything. And I get up and pound on the door, and Dorothy came to the door, my wife. And, of course, she talked to me through the screen door. I didn't get in, see? And so in the conversation, I pointed out to her that these screens should not be up in the house in the middle of winter, that she needed a man around the house to take care of those details. But she allowed us how she did need a man around the house, but she sure didn't need one that badly. So I didn't get in, but she did tell me about this Dr. Smith in Akron, and would I like to meet him? So Virginia had communicated about Dr. Strong and so forth and Dr. Smith, so Dorothy asked me if I'd like to meet this Dr. Smith, and I told her, yes, I had nothing to lose. So Dorothy put me in her automobile, took me down to the bus depot, and bought me a one-way ticket to Akron. And she gave me Doc Smith's name and address, and that's how I met my sponsor. And eventually, Doc put me in Akron City Hospital, in Akron, Ohio, and that is how I started my career in this fellowship. And in that hospital, I met the men down there who had preceded me in the fellowship. These fellows all belonged to the Oxford movement. They were all rummies who came to see me. I still have their names. They all put their names on a sheet of paper when they come to visit me. And those fellas all told me the story of their lives with alcohol, what had happened to them. And now they are without drinking and feeling pretty good about it. And those men did something to me. They inspired me. They had something I wanted. And I felt like you heard read a while ago, this fifth chapter. That feeling I had says if you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, you're not ready to take certain steps. Well, we didn't have steps then. We didn't have the book. We didn't have the AA program then. That hadn't come into being yet. But these men, their power of example did something to me. They told me their stories and I related to those fellas. They are all older men than I was. That's why I've outlived them all, I guess. They were all fellas 45, 50 years old and up. And I had just passed my 35th birthday at this time. You don't have to take your shoes off. I'll tell you, I'll be 73 years old next Christmas. So, those fellas were considerably older, but they had the same experiences, and I did in the 8 or 9 years of my drinking what they took some of those fellas 30 to do, believe me. I was one of these fellas that didn't do any fooling when it come to boozing. I do everything this way. I still do. It's part of the nature of the beast. I'm an extremist like every rummy is. Well, anyway, these men impressed me, and I wanted to be one of them. I didn't belong to anything. I didn't even belong to the human race, really. From that feeling I had standing on that waterfront, I didn't feel I belonged anywhere. But these fellas were the first people that showed me any love or consideration. And I wanted to be one of those in the worst way, so I shall never forget the last day I was in this hospital. My sponsor, Doc, came in, and as he always did every day, he came in and he sat on in the afternoon of this last day. I was in there a week. And he sat on the foot of my bed, which is a very unprofessional posture, but he always did this. He did things different than other doctors did. And he looked at me. He says, "Well, young fella," he says, "what do you think of all these things by now?" He had a name for everyone. I don't think he knew the names of any of the fellas. He had a name he tacked on all of us. I was always young fella to him. The only time that I was ever Clarence to him is when he was mad at me. When he'd holler, "Clarence," he had that Vermont accent, that heavy accent. "Clarence," when he hollered that, I know I'm in trouble. But when he calls me young fella, things are going along all right. So this day, everything's all right because I'm just getting started here. And he says, "Young fella, what do you think of all this by now?" I says, "Doc, I think this is wonderful." I says, "All these fellas coming in, I don't know them from a load of hay. And they all telling me the stories of their lives and what had happened to them through booze." He says, "Yeah." I says, "But there's one thing that puzzles me." He says, "And what's that?" I said, "They all tell me the same thing before they leave. They tell me that they have the answer to my drinking problem, but they leave on that note and they don't tell me what the answer is." Says, "What happens to me now? What are you going to do? What's the answer to this thing?" I had all kinds of little things running around in this blubber about what's going to happen. I was looking for an operation. I'll tell you why. The first time I went down to see Doc, I ran out on him. He scared me to death. But I went down, when Dorothy put me in that car and took me down, I went up to his office, which is on the 6th floor of the Second National Bank building in Akron, and he wasn't in his office when I got there, so I figured I'd have to wait, and it was cold outside, and I didn't want to leave because it was cold and it was warm in there. If I got out on the street, I might get picked up anyway, so I thought I better stay in there. So I spent my time walking up and down the hallway there and keep passing his office all the time. And every time I'd pass his office, I would just automatically look at the window, and there's a sign on there, "Dr. Robert Holbrook Smith, rectal surgeon." Yes, sir. It occurred to me that there's certainly a new approach to alcoholism. So I was expecting anything. Here, when I asked Doc, I says, "What are you going to do to me? Where do I go? What's what? What's next?" I've been in here a week. I'll never forget this. Old Doc always gave me the round-the-barn treatment. He always gave me the negative treatment. He always shook me up. He was tough. He looks at me, he says, "Well, young fella, we don't know about you. You're pretty young, and we don't know if you've had enough yet." Jesus, I weigh 130 pounds. I hadn't worked in 3 years. On the bum all this time, over 3 years. I was unemployable. And if you don't think I was unemployable, let me tell you this. These were WPA days, you know. And anybody but anybody ought to be able to get on WPA. A lot of you people aren't old enough to remember WPA, but I see some gray heads around here and bald heads that can remember it. This is a thing that Roosevelt instituted back in the deepest depression days to try to help people keep body and soul together. They had all kinds of projects, fixing roads, fixing streets, just digging up things and digging up holes and filling them again, doing anything. But they paid you $18 a week for this. They give you 45 cents an hour. That was a going rate for labor in those days. So people, anyone who wanted to, could get themselves down to the office, could get on WPA. That is all but me. All my jug buddies got on WPA and they wouldn't take me. Now, if you can imagine, a guy that can't get on WPA, he has to be a pretty sorry mess. That gives you one idea, and that isn't bad enough. Dorothy was always very much interested in my going to work. And she did her best, and do you know what Dorothy's job was? Dorothy was the head of the men's department in an employment agency. And she couldn't get me a job. So this is my situation. And 130 pounds, and so mixed up that I couldn't find my way out of a telephone booth. I was so screwed up. So Doc hands me that bill of goods about maybe I haven't had enough yet. I'm not old enough yet, see? Well, I practically had to fight my way into this thing. I had to convince him that I was ready to quit drinking. I think that had a lot to do with that part in that fifth chapter. It says, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, you're ready now, you know. I certainly was ready, and I convinced him I was. He says, okay, young fella, I'll give you the answer to all this thing. Now, here's the way this program was introduced to me. Doc says, I'll give you the answer. He says, get down off of that bed. I says, for what? He says, get down on that floor or you're going to pray. I says, who's going to pray? He says, you're going to pray. I says, I don't know anything about praying. He says, I don't suppose you do. But he says, I'll pray, and that'll do for this time. He had first asked me if I believed in God, you know. And I, when he told me this, when he asked this God business, this shook me up. I didn't want any part of this God situation. So I had to evade this question. But Doc is a person you don't evade. So when he said, do I believe in God, I had to beat this one, so I, the best I can come up with, I says, what does that have to do with it? He says, young fella, that has everything to do with it. Do you or do you not believe in God? Well, this man wants an answer. So the next best thing I came along with was, well, I guess I do. He says, there's no guessing about it, you do or you don't. Now, how do you like this approach for people starting in AA, you know? These squeamish guys about the God angle. He made me admit, I finally admitted that I did believe in God. He says, okay, now we can get someplace. That's when he tumbled me out of that hay right on that cold concrete in that shorty nightgown on my bare knees. Cold November, or February day. And he uttered a prayer, and he had me repeat it after him. I don't remember what it was. I wish I did. But I can imagine what it was. But I remember this. After we concluded that little prayer, he shook hands with me. He says, young fellow, you're going to be all right. That night he carried me to this meeting of the Oxford Movement. Well, I didn't know what I was going into, and I got my first big shock when I went into this Oxford group meeting. It was at the home of T. Henry and Clarissa Williams in Akron. They were the head moguls in the Oxford Movement down in that area, And they had all of their meetings in their home. They had a beautiful, sumptuous home there. And T. Henry had a big living room, and he had a recreation room down in the basement there. And I went to this meeting, and I looked around at all these people, and it scared to death. I got scared to death at this thing, because there were a lot of women in there, and I couldn't understand what they're doing there. And I knew that I was mixed up with a bunch of rummies, but what all those women were doing in there, and those ladies, I couldn't figure them out. And an awful lot of people who were not alcoholics. The alcoholics were a minority group in those days, in the Oxford group, by a long shot. We were in there on sufferance. The Oxford group people were so convicted that they could help anyone through spiritual means that they tackle anybody. It didn't make any difference what your problem was. They figured that you could find it through turning your will and your life over to the care of God and doing certain things according to how they set up and did them. And so they tackled the alcoholics, and this was the biggest mistake the Oxford group ever made, because we damn near ruined them. But anyway, I got in there, and I looked around, and I see all these people, and these women scared me. I'm not frightened of girls anymore. I love them now, but I gotten over that with the years. But I was scared, and I felt like a fish out of water. But I went, and I went down there every Wednesday night to meetings to Akron, Ohio. And it took me a long time to figure out just what I was belonging to down there. I'd go down weekends to be with these people, the alcoholics, and I went Wednesday night to be at the regular meetings. And I had a 75-mile round trip to go to meetings. People don't have that today. I didn't have the transportation facilities you have today either. And I didn't have the other advantages a lot of people have, money and one thing and another. But anyway, Dorothy, after I got into the Oxford group, she let me come back home. See, this boy's going to get fixed. I'm going to be all right and go to work and be a gentleman and be a real father and a family man. So she let me come back home. I guess Doc must have had something to do with that. So I moved in, and the next thing you know, I'm running all over creation. My sponsor told me that I would have to spend the rest of my life fixing drunks. He says, you're the only person can do it. You're an alcoholic and no one else can fix drunks but another rummy. And he said, you'll have to go out and spend your life as an avocation, he said. You're going to have to make a living, but you'll have to do this as an avocation. You'll spend your life fixing drunks because you are qualified to do it, and you are an expert in it, having lived through it. And he convinced me this is what I'd have to do with my life. And I guess he really convinced me, because I've still been doing it all these years. I'm still at it. And it's a great thing as far as I'm concerned. Well, anyway, here's what happened to me. I was very much interested in what Lois said this morning about her frustrations with Bill after he got sober. And I lived right with her on this morning, because that same thing happened to me. I was the nobody in that family. I was the nothing and less than nothing. And all of a sudden I get important. I become important to people. You understand, in those days we had no central office. We had no literature. We had no book. We had none of these advantages that people have today. We had no groups. We had nothing. This was all pioneering. I had to go out and meet rummies any place I could do and try to shake them down and pound this idea into them. So I relieved my sponsor, and I went back to Cleveland, and I became the first and foremost bar stool snatcher in history. I went every place where there were rummies, and I went every place who had anything to do with rummies. I went to doctors, I went to psychiatrists, I went to clergymen, I went to the Associated Charities, I went all, and the judges and police and everybody, to work on the rummies that were giving them problems. And they gave me plenty of rummies to work on, believe me. So a rummy was in danger for me. When I see a rummy someplace, boy, he got a pitch. But I didn't have any success doing this. You know, I was driven by something there that I felt that I'd never really be a real member of this, never really be an Indian. I'd never win my feather till I had sponsored somebody. I wanted to get some guy down in that hospital in Akron, Ohio, and that was my goal. And I felt that I would be accomplishing something if that would ever happen. I'd be a real accepted member of the fellowship. Do you know there was no shortage of rummies in those days? There was a depression on, a lot of people not working. You could find them everywhere. There was tons of them around. And it took me 7 long, heart-rending months and talking to hundreds of rummies before I ever got my first one in that hospital. And I shall never forget that first fella that I sponsored. I can look back now and see why it took me 7 long months to get my first rummy.